The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Yes, coming to you cordless, up to the satellite, down to your house, down to your phone, and you're sitting in bed. That's my fantasy, anyway. It's 11:02 on the East Coast of the United States, 8:02 on the West Coast, 10:02 where I'm sitting here in Ilhan Omar's district in Northeast Minneapolis. I'm Jim Peters, and welcome to another edition of Jim Peters at Night. I think it's show number 33. We're starting our 10th week this week. I know, hooray for us. I do want to thank you folks for something. I was in the UP for a long weekend. That's the reason we didn't have a show on Thursday. And I visited the towns of Marinette, Wisconsin, and Menominee, Michigan, right there on the UP border. Menominee, Michigan is the southernmost point in the UP. And those towns, they call themselves Little Twin Cities, and they are, because they're literally right across the Menominee River from each other. And one's in Wisconsin and one's in Michigan. But they treat themselves like one city. And they're on the Green Bay, not Green Bay, Wisconsin, the city. They're on the Green Bay. Green Bay is a body of water. It's a very large bay in, that's Lake Michigan. I'm trying to think. It's not Superior and it's not Huron. It's Lake Michigan. Anyway, I had a really good time. I've talked about this before. They have a strange sort of civilization up there, and I don't mean that strange in the sense that people are shooting guns, which a lot of people send me emails and said, why are you going there? Everyone shoots each other. No, they don't. They do not. But I'll tell you what they do have is it's like, okay, so I live in the 15th largest city in the U.S., Minneapolis, St. Paul, Twin Cities both. The Twin Cities Metro is a huge amalgam of different municipalities, including Minneapolis and St. Paul proper. But driving around there, even though you go farther distances, doesn't take any longer than driving around here. You know, for me to go to the supermarket, it's about a 20-minute drive. If I want to go, you know, go to my wife's drugstore, it's about 30 minutes. You know, pretty much I got to drive pretty much anywhere, right? And so they got this thing where, you know, if they go to the supermarket, it's about 20 minutes, except they're driving, you know, 30 miles. I'm driving maybe 6. But in time, it's about the same. And with the modern conveniences of Zoom and being able to work at home and all this sort of stuff, I think more and more people are going to be living there. It's actually, here's the deal. It's a great place to visit. My friend moved there about 4 years ago. I thought he was nuts. He was an urban person. He loves it, and I understand why they like it. I really do. For a certain type of person, it's really, really nice. It really is. I don't know if I could handle it full-time, 24/7, but I enjoy going. So I want to thank my friends Mike and Karen for putting us up and showing us around. We do this trip pretty much every year at the same time because the colors are nice here. And speaking of colors, okay, I want to bitch about something else, too. It's going to get cold here soon. And haven't done this show during the winter, and I don't know what the fuck I'm going to do. It's already getting cold in the studio. I don't want to put a sweater on because I think it's, I don't know if you noticed, I basically have a series of black and or gray t-shirts I wear on the air. It's not the same shirt, folks. It isn't. I have a lot of them, too. I get them at Target for $6, you know, shit. So, and they're all a little, not all, but they're a little different. But I'm going to start wearing a sweater. I don't know. I mean, I got my hands, you know, it's like, shit. I got first world problems. So I was going to say, before I got off the track from myself, I want to thank you folks. Over the weekend, we cracked 600 followers on Rumble. And thank you very much. I appreciate that. And if you want to go to Rumble, I've told you this before. So we're broadcasting on 8 different platforms simultaneously. 7 video, 1 audio. The audio is Spreaker. That's audio only, where you need the Spreaker app to hear us live. But all our broadcasts are immediately turned into podcasts on Spreaker. And so you can download them on demand after the fact, of course. So of those 8 platforms, the only one I really pay any attention to the numbers of is Rumble, because as I predicted when we started this, that's where we're going to the vast majority of our viewers. So, and that even includes YouTube. We don't have any real YouTube viewers to speak of, yet alone on Rumble. We've had several videos that have had several thousand people watching. And like I said, we've only been doing this for 10 weeks. And that's pretty damn cool. I have to hand it to you folks. It's like we're taking our business. How's it go? We're kicking ass and taking names. And I can say that because we're not on the radio. So I want you folks to also, along with that, you can check out our website at jimandnight.com. And God damn it, I was going to pull it up here and I forgot to, I don't like to show a lot of websites. I know that a lot of people who do these shows, they show a lot of websites. My thing is, unless you can actually read something on the screen, it's not worth showing. And usually you can't. And usually most of you, at least half of you, are on your mobile phones where the picture is about, you know, it's like the early days of TV. It's like, you know, Mr. Television. You know, that doesn't mean anything to you folks. Milton Berle. Milton Berle was the very first television star in 1948, Texaco Star Theater. And televisions in 1948 had basically a 2x3-inch screen. I'm not kidding. That was the whole thing. It was like, here, like this big. That was the screen. And that's the screen on your, especially if you keep your phone in portrait mode, that's the size of the screen on your cell phone too, but it's not going to get any bigger, you know? So we went from that, from 2x3-inch little cathode ray television to, I still remember, we lived in an apartment. This is going back 20 years now, in a converted building in Minneapolis. As a matter of fact, it's one of the oldest buildings in the city, and it was a rubber plant, and they turned it into apartments. And they kept the 12-foot ceilings. It was really cool. We had a very nice apartment, very nice. But it was 50 stairs up to our apartment because the ceilings were 12 feet tall, and we're on the third floor, top floor of this building, and there was no elevator. And I still remember bringing this giant, giant television, this fucking cathode ray monster. It wasn't even that it was heavy, although it was. I could barely get my arms around it. I'd drag it up 50 stairs, went home, you know, got in the apartment, hooked it up, didn't work. had to take it back and do it again. It's like, Jesus Christ. And those televisions, my God, really, they were dinosaurs. And then all of a sudden, my neighbor bought a 55-inch television with a Roku included, you know, built in smart TV at Costco for $255. Really? Even cathode ray televisions weren't that cheap and the pictures sucked. But anyway, okay. So anyway, I'm getting off the track. I get off the track, man. It's like terrible. If you want to go, you go to our website, jimandnight.com. What I was talking about is the fact I don't like to show websites on the screen unless you can obviously read something. But I was going to put our website up. You'll notice when we do our interview, we pre-taped our interview with John J. Miller, the author. I did put his books on the screen several times. And you can see the book because the pictures are large enough. Anyway, go to jimandnight.com, and there's at the bottom of the page there, on the front page, we always have a list of upcoming guests, and we update it every few days, depending on what we know is coming up. And there's in the menu, there's a tab called Watch, and there's a listing there and links to where all the 7 platforms you can watch this on. But as I said, I would appreciate it. I mean, we're concentrating on Rumble. So if you want to watch on Rumble, I would appreciate that very much. And so I know some people watch on YouTube. If you go to the episodes tab, there's a list. There's not a listing. There's thumbnails there for all of the videos, the shows we've done. And you click one, you can watch it after the fact, of course. We did have a thing at the very beginning on the front page where you could watch the show live, but that technically that got goofy, so I stopped it. Anyway, so let me give you the an update to what's happening here in the next few days. We got guests. We got a lot of guests. Tonight, John J. Miller. He's an author. He's a professor of journalism at Hillsdale College, and he wrote the book The Big Scrum, which is about the early days of collegiate American football in the United States. That's redundant. It's American football. But it actually isn't, because you'll hear the interview. Very early football was basically a variation of rugby. And it slowly morphed into what it is today. And the really big thing was in 1906, they legalized the forward pass. And if you know anything about rugby and, of course, soccer, in rugby you can pass the ball forward. You can only pass it backwards. And in soccer, you can't pass the ball with your hands at all. That's the idea of the game. So the forward pass made American football completely unique from all the other quote-unquote football-type games. And, you know, he even talks about this, too, about the fact that it was called football, and yet all of a sudden people are throwing the ball around with the bandit, and he said some people thought that was just odd. Is it football? Is it passball? What is it, you know? Anyway, he's tonight. Tomorrow, the King brothers, they got an interesting story. They're talk show hosts. They started a talk show in their garage in Palo Alto, California, and people showed up. they used the garage, you know, the inside of the garage as their set, you know, and of course it's California, it's Palo Alto, so the weather's almost always nice. And they put folding chairs out in the driveway, and pretty soon they're getting 100, 150 people to come watch their show. You know, they're posting on YouTube. So anyway, they got an interesting story. They're good guys. Wednesday, Martha Zoller is going to be joining us. She does an Atlanta conservative talk show on WDUN, actually Gainesville, Atlanta Metro. A wonderful woman. She was voted the 2023 Woman of the Year at the Talkers Convention, which was the big convention of talk media in the United States. And she deserved it. I was at that convention, and I spent some time with her, some quality time. We had a very nice time. And she's coming on Wednesday, and we'll talk about a whole bunch of stuff. Woman's very opinionated, very well-spoken. She's a talk show host, you know, what can I tell you? You know, she started by calling into a talk show at I don't know if it was WDUN or another station in Atlanta, but that's how she got her. She was so impressed her with, she was a call-in, you know, just like you can call in here by going to jimandnight.com/call. Well, I'll get to that in a second. Anyway, she's going to be on Wednesday. Thursday, I'm taking off again. I know it's two Thursdays in a row. I know that. I got shit I got to do. That's all I'm going to mention. All I got to tell you. Monday, Larry Newman's going to be here. Now, normally, he's our Bigfoot investigator, but he's not coming on in this role. He is, by profession, a bail bondsman, and he's going to talk about what cashless bail is doing in the United States. That's what he's talking to talk about. Tuesday, we have Eddie Scarry, the author, on. He wrote a book called Liberal Misery. He wrote it a couple of years ago. It's fantastic, though. And the reason I want him on so badly is because he basically addresses something I've been talking about for a long time. That is, the differences between liberals and conservatives are not political. At the end of the day, it's a personality type. It's different personality types are attracted to different political ideologies. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. And he wrote a whole book about that very concept. So he's going to talk about that. And we do have a guest for Wednesday, except I'm not going to announce it yet because I haven't actually, next Wednesday, I haven't actually booked it. So, okay, so you can go to jimandnight.com/call. It says call in at the top menu. You go there. You can click the big, huge, enormous blue button at the top of the screen. You will end up in a preview page. Check your camera and mic. If you don't want to be on the screen, there's a pull down there. The last entrance is always no video, and that will mute your camera, so we only hear your microphone. And then I would appreciate it if you do that. You have the option then of uploading an avatar or a picture of anything. Could be yourself, could be Mickey Mouse, you know, who knows. And I would appreciate it if you do that. This is a visual medium. You know, what do I say? So we pre-taped the interview with John J. Miller this afternoon, and we're going to run in a few minutes. In the meantime, I want to comment on what's going on here a little bit. I'll tell you what's going on. Israel is about to kick Hamas's ass. That's what's going on, and good for them. Now, it's hard to. My friend Jazz Shaw comes on the show regularly, and I'm hoping to have him on before the end of the month because he needs to talk about this stuff. He wrote a piece on hotair.com today about the fact that, oh, really, it wasn't much of his opinion other than the fact that he was glad this happened. Rasmussen did a poll over the weekend of Americans and asked them what they thought, like, who are the Israelis justified for going after Hamas after what they did? And the vast majority of Americans said, yes, they are. Matter of fact, let me read you the statistics here. 53% of likely U.S. voters said they believe the Palestinians are mostly to blame for the conflict in Israel. Only 10% think Israel is mostly to blame. 24% said both sides are about equally to blame. And another 13% didn't have an opinion anyway. But you'll see, you can see 53% is not a large majority, but considering all those other choices, it was by far the most, the box most checked. I asked John Miller this in the interview you're about to hear about why this is happening on college campuses. I saw a meme yesterday online, and the meme kind of went like this. You know, college kids through the ages, 1920s, phone pranks, 1940s, got into how many people you get in a Volkswagen, you know, 2020s, we're gonna have a Hitler type march, celebrating Hamas. Why? What? What? You are? Because you basically have to go against the grain of any common sense. So it's easy to say that these kids have been hypnotized and brainwashed by their professors. And actually they have. That's what's going on. The problem for them, the problem is now that nothing, you know, has nothing has exposed the bullshit of this more than this little dilemma here in Israel. Nothing. And you, Jim's brain fucked up again. The thing is, are we really, are you just battling common sense? Is that all that's going on here? Why are these people so stupid? And this is actually a question I have. Like, for a lot of people come on the show, why are these kids? Now, kids, you expect kids to be stupid. The problem with the academia is that they basically never lived in the real world. Most of these people most of the people in collegiate academia a lot of them have never had a real job outside of academia. They just think that because they think something is true. And I hate to say it, and Eddie Scarry will talk about this next week. That is one of the hallmarks of liberal ideology, is that because you had an idea, therefore it has to be right. And we all know that's bullshit. Look at communism, you know? I mean, I've said this many times. Communism looks great on paper. You read that, you think, oh my God, this is terrific. One problem, it doesn't work. And socialism doesn't work, too. And my liberal friends will try to tell me, well, no, it's not real socialism. It's democratic socialism. We're going to institute democratic socialism. Guess what? That won't work either. It won't. And I'll tell you why it won't work. I can tell you specifically why it won't work. It doesn't take into account two natural human traits. One is the trait of possession. People want to own stuff. Little babies know that sucker thing belongs to them. They know that's theirs. Little babies know this stuff, right? And the second one's incentive. It doesn't recognize any incentive. Most people have, and I know that in the real world, it doesn't always work out this way, but there's this natural human trait to think, if I work harder, I should get more rewards. I should get, well, in this case, more money. That's what people think. And communism and socialism completely take that off the table. Now, and then you think, well, you think that Karl Marx can write around that. No, he can't. He can go on till he's blue in the face. He didn't address that, and the whole thing's faulty. It doesn't work. And I'm not trying to be an ideologue here. It's been every single time it's been tried, it hasn't worked. Look at Venezuela. Best example, 30 years ago, the richest country in South America. Now, people are killing their pets to eat. It's fucking unbelievable. And so you want an example? Well, there you go. And that, this is recent. I mean, this is happening now. The Chinese, they got an interesting thing going on there. They're trying to combine a communist government with a capitalist economic system. And it's, I have to say, as an experiment, it's almost as daring as the American experiment in democracy. Right now, arguably, it's working. Arguably not. Well, there's a problem with this. We don't get, because of the way that, you know, the fact that the communist government in China runs the economy, we're not getting any accurate figures. Nobody is. Matter of fact, they probably even aren't. They are probably not getting accurate figures on exactly economically what's going on in their country. Right now, it's not going well. It's, you know, now, whether they can survive this or not, they got one thing going on us in spades that we'll never be able to top, and that is democracy is really, really messy. I mean, it's messy, and it's slow, and it's plodding. I mean, I have a friend of mine who's been working on this bicycle project with the state of Minnesota for like 5 years, and listening to him talk about it, oh, Jesus Christ. I mean, it drags on forever, and people have different opinions, and people are don't want to, you know, there are people want to kill it, and, you know, and him and his cohorts, they're just they're plugging away, but they've been doing this for 5 years now. This is for, I'm not kidding, it's for a 1.5 mile bicycle path. Yes, you heard me right, 1.5 miles, and it's a logistical nightmare. But that is what democracy is. Look what's going on in the House of Representatives right now. They fucked themselves because they took out a speaker who was probably as good a speaker as you probably get under the circumstances. You know, the problem is you got 217 people who each have an opinion, and every one of them thinks they're right. I just kind of maybe in a way blew my thing about the fact that all Democrats think when they have an idea it has to be correct. You know, there's a and the thing that happened there, and that Gates, you know, Jeff Meyer came on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking, and I understand he has a very valid point of view that a lot of these the people in the conservatives in the Republican Party in the House think if we don't take care of the budget now, when's it going to happen? You know, Jeff was saying he's absolutely right. It doesn't matter when you pull the bandage off; it's going to hurt bad. But the thing is, I stumped the thing about this, and yeah, there's still an aspect of timing in life. You have to, you know, timing is very important. And by doing this now, at this moment, they're not accomplishing anything. Or when I say doing this now, I mean trying to, you know, force the government into a balanced budget and address the debt. It's not going to happen ASAP. It isn't. Now, you know, that's the thing. I mean, like I said, I acknowledge the fact that Jeff and the people who think that way, and Matt Gaetz, that they have a very valid point of view. But what's the point of blowing the whole thing up unless you're going to accomplish something? And so far, nothing's been accomplished by this. You know, and then it turns out, and you can't predict the future, it turns out because of this Israeli thing, the timing is now awful. And not only that, they look like idiots. There's the optics, too. There's that. I mean, I was on here railing about these stupid morons, and I in retrospect, I think I was a little harsh, because like I said, Jeff and Matt Gaetz, they have a point here, and the point should be, because seriously, if nobody does anything ever, at some point, this will economically collapse the country. There's no doubt about it. I mean, right now we have more debt, or how does it work? The interest on the debt is more than the 100% of the GDP or something like that. And if the debt clicks up just a couple interest rate points, just a couple, all of a sudden it's extremely expensive. I mean, we might not be able to service this debt that we have. We're $32 trillion in debt. And that means we owe a bunch of banks $32 trillion. When I say we, I mean the federal government. They do. But on the other hand, too, they seem to think, when I say they, am now I'm talking about the people in the House and the Senate, that they could just, you know, have an unlimited number, a spigot to unlimited taxation cash. And no, they can't. At some point, you just can't tax people anymore. And that's the other thing I was talking with Jeff about, too, on that show, about the fact that at some point, this country was founded by people who revolted against taxation. You have to go back. That was the actual reason for the revolt, for the revolution, is they were getting taxed without being representative in Parliament, and they got that pissed them off. And so we you know, at what point does the same thing happen here? Especially when you look at what our tax dollars are going toward, and we've always, most of the presidential administrations we've had, executive, have been basically been incompetent. This one particularly so. These people can't seem to do anything right at all. And the only things they haven't fucked up is the Ukraine war yet. I still think they will. And this thing that just happened in Israel, so far they haven't fucked that up either. But every single other thing has gone down the toilet in the last 3 years. So, I want to, here's an example. Before we go on to the interview with John Miller, I want to bring up one thing here. I give you some statistics just from the Rasmussen poll about the fact the vast majority of Americans are for Israel going after Hamas. There's another way to look at this, too. And that is, MSNBC, who when the war first started, you know, 10 days ago, they got on their little cable channel there, and they started to identify with the Palestinians, and their viewership in a week dropped 33%. People don't want to hear this. Now, the interesting thing about that is, in that week, MSNBC's ratings dropped 33%. CNN added 17% of their viewers to their ratings. Fox News, which already has ratings like three or four times the two of them, added 42% to their viewers. So in other words, MSNBC lost a bunch of viewers, and you think normally they would go to CNN. They didn't. They mostly went to Fox News. CNN has lost 90% of its viewership in the last 3 years since Biden was inaugurated. Since January of 21, they've lost 90%. You did not hear that wrong. They've lost 90% of their viewership. Now, the reason you're saying, well, how can they survive? They survive because of what's called carriage fees. I've explained this before. I'm going to explain it again. When you pay your cable bill, a certain amount of money from your cable bill goes to every single channel on your cable system. That's the reason your cable bill is so freaking high. That's the reason you're paying. I just read this a couple weeks ago. The average cable bill in the United States, and when I say cable, I'm talking about YouTube TV and Hulu Live and any way you get linear paid television other than Comcast or Charter or whatever the hell it is. The average bill is $124 a month. And if you stop and think about it, that's fucking crazy. You're paying $124 a month for television? All right, so you got 90 channels, fine. How many do you watch? But the problem is, so the people who produce the channels, who run the channels, figured this out a long time ago, and that is, if we basically bond together and insist that you pay us, you being the cable companies, you got to pay everybody. So of the 90 channels, you're watching maybe 15, but you're paying for 90 of them. Now, CNN was the very first cable channel to actually be exclusively on cable television. July 1980, it started. 1 year later, MTV, that was second. So, I mean, they got a legacy here, and also they have a reputation of being, you know, quote-unquote, the most trusted name in news. They aren't anymore. Everyone's figured out that they're, you know, I mean, I've said this many times. You got MSNBC... All right, got a left-wing bias. Okay, fine. You know what you're getting. You tune in All right, they support Hamas. They support the Palestinians. Okay, you may not like that. You tune out, right? Now, they want viewers. They don't like the fact you've tuned out either. In the last few days, they've started to modify their message somewhat. But still, you get a, you know what you're getting. You watch Fox News, it's right wing. You know what you're getting. You watch Newsmax, it's right wing. You know what you're getting. You listen to NPR, it's left wing. You know what you're getting. CNN is still advertising itself as an objective news source, and nothing can be further from the truth. They're actually more left-wing than MSNBC is, and anybody who watches that for 5 freaking minutes can tell. I don't watch it too much anymore. My mother has it on 24/7, bless her heart. I see it when I'm at her house. I don't need to watch it. I know what they're talking about. I know what's going on over there. I don't need to watch it. But, So CNN, this but my problem with CNN in particular, a lot of people's problems, they're not objective. They aren't, even though they're advertising themselves as such. So of your $124 of your cable bill, about, I think, $1.50 goes to CNN. So historically, the biggest single cable channel or group of channels has been ESPN. $7 of your cable bill goes to ESPN. I think it's more than that now, but CNN's viewership is dropping very steadily, and finally Charter Communications told Disney, that owns ESPN, they said, well, we're not paying for it anymore. And so right now, suddenly, you can't get ESPN on Charter Cable. Charter thinks the $7 fee is too high for what their customers are getting. I would have a tendency to think they're right. Now, the next thing that happens here, they've been going back and forth, negotiating, but it doesn't look like Charter's going to budge. And what's going to happen is that ESPN will end up with ESPN Plus, where you pay ESPN directly $7 a month, and you can watch ESPN. That's what's going to happen. And once that happens, all hell's going to break loose, because basically everybody on the cable system will start doing that. Now, right now, there's Discovery Plus. You have the Warner Discovery channels. You know, that's History Channel, you know, TLC, Home and Garden, HDTV, all that sort of stuff they own. Those are all Discovery's channels. But if I'm correct, and I have Discovery Plus, if I'm correct, you can't actually watch any of those things live on, linear. You can't watch a linear TV on Discovery Plus. Peacock is they're doing a hybrid method, which I find very interesting. You can watch live stuff on Peacock, and you watch live channels, but you can also access the archives, and what you get is depending on how much you pay. And there's a free tier. You can use the Peacock channel for free. Why am I talking about all this? The reason is because, like I said, CNN can't justify the $1.50 fee with the small number of viewers they have now. They aren't even coming close to cracking a million, and in cable television, a million is basically, that's anything below a million is zero for all practical purposes, and they're completely in the dumper. So I brought that up because I think that also proves MSNBC's viewership drop in the last 10 days also proves the fact that Americans aren't really handling, they don't want to deal with this shit anymore. They're tired of, and Jazz Shaw wrote another article on Hot Air talking about the fact that even though if you watch the press and you see all of these kids demonstrating at Harvard, all these college campuses, that basically they get a lot of airtime on the television screen, but nobody really agrees with them. And you wouldn't get that impression looking at the news coverage of these demonstrations. You would not. You would, and that's of course exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to put in your mind the fact that what they have to say is way more popular than what it is. It isn't. Basically, nobody agrees with these kids except the professors. That's it. And I hate to say this, kids, and I don't call them kids, anybody under, at this point, I'd say anybody under the age of 30 even, they're kids, they're stupid. They're stupid by definition. They're just getting started in life. They're in college for a reason, to educate themselves. Of course, what the education they get now is largely bullshit. I mean, just today, there was a survey of a major corporate business said there's way more jobs are going to open up now that won't need a college degree, because people are starting to realize the college degree is worthless. Also, when you have the government funding your loan expansion plans, that's the primary reason the cost of college has gone up, is because you can get a loan. You know, they're not stupid. They know what's going on. All right. I've gone on too long, as usual. So, right now, we're going to run the interview with John J. Miller. It's about 35 minutes. You will like it. Trust me. Here we go. Joining us, John J. Miller, author, founder of The College Fix. Hey, John, I forgot to ask you, where are you right now?
I'm in Hillsdale, Michigan. I'm on the campus of Hillsdale College.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's good. I was just at the UP this weekend. A lot of fun.
Well, so were my kids, actually. Two of them were. They went to a road rally near Marquette.
Oh, yeah. Gotta love the road rallies. Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's good. Well, hey, so the reason I'm asking you on here is because I'm really fascinated by your book, The Big Scrum. So tell us about the beginnings of American football. This started about, what, 1860, 1869?
Way back then. So the book is called The Big Scrum, and the subtitle is How Teddy Roosevelt Saved Football. And so it's a story of the birth of American football, and partially a biography of Teddy Roosevelt, who played an indispensable role in creating the game we know today. Also a very little-known role that hadn't been written about, certainly not at any great length before my book came along. But it talks about the origins of football, where this sport comes from and why it became so popular, and then what Teddy Roosevelt has to do with the whole thing.
Yeah. So when did football basically, it was basically started more like a modification of rugby, right?
Essentially, yes. So after the Civil War, we see the rise of team sports in the United States, and baseball becomes very popular right away, but so does football. And it's a kind of, in the United States, it's a cross between what we call soccer, also rugby, and so on. And it takes a few years to develop, but in the 1870s, 1880s, it's starting to look a little bit like the game we know, where you can pick up the ball and run and so forth. And by the 1880s, 1890s, it's becoming really popular. Americans are enjoying this sport. They're turning out for games on weekends in the fall. And it's just becoming, it's becoming a really popular sport, but it's also developing as the rules are coming together, and the people playing it are also creating it at the same time. So it didn't come to them all with the rules all written down. They had to figure out a few things and how to make this game as fun as it is now.
And this was mostly on college campuses, correct? There was no professional, like, league.
No, professional football is not till much later. So this was driven by colleges and universities. And for example, Teddy Roosevelt, in the year 1876, attended a football game for the first time. He was a freshman at Harvard. He was 18 years old. He got on a train in Cambridge and went down to New Haven, Connecticut, and watched Harvard and Yale play football for the second time ever. He'd never seen it before. And it was just him and a bunch of his friends, and the game was primitive. There were no quarterbacks. There were no wide receivers. There were just a lot of things that were different from today. It was football in its embryonic form. But he went and watched it, and he enjoyed it. He didn't like the fact that Harvard lost that day. He was upset about that, and thought it was because of bad officiating. But as he said in a letter to his mother, but he did watch it, and he enjoyed it, and it became an important part of his life, as it was so many of other Americans who just enjoyed the sport, watching it as a kind of entertainment.
When you were writing the book, did you get any feel of what particularly attracted people, and especially college students, to this? Was it the violence?
Well, I think the number one, the excitement. It's just an exciting game to watch. It's they were excited about it the way we're excited about it. I mean, who doesn't love a great college football game on a Saturday? I think they had a similar kind of experience. And competing against other colleges and rival colleges. You know, Harvard and Yale, my gosh, that's one of the great athletic rivalries in all of America. We think of the Ivy League as the greatest research institutions in the United States, but the Ivy League is actually an athletic conference. We define these schools by what athletic conference they belong to. So it's an exciting game. I think people get passionate about supporting their school, beating rival schools, that sort of thing. I do think people like the violence of it, but also the speed, the grace. There are so many other things, but they do like, you know, they do like large guys knocking into each other.
But at this point, we should point out there was absolutely no forward passing to speak of. It was more the rugby thing where you could pass the ball backwards but not forward, correct?
Correct. So in the 1880s, 1890s, as this sport is becoming more and more popular and they're starting to fill stadiums and Thanksgiving Day games are becoming spectacles and so forth, the game looks an awful lot like rugby. So there are some differences, but it looks a lot like rugby where you have a bunch of guys compressed on a small area of the field. They're pushing and shoving. They have a lot of handoffs. They have lateral, which is to say backwards passes. They cannot throw the ball downfield. There's no such thing as a wide receiver. That's actually an illegal play. You cannot do that up to this point.
And basically every school played with their own more or less house rules, right?
Well, there were a variety of rules. What happens in the 1880s and at the end of the 19th century is the rules become standardized. So for example, in that second football game between Yale and Harvard, the one that Theodore Roosevelt watched, the captains of the two teams met on the field beforehand to determine a bunch of rules that were arbitrary. And they decided, for example, they were going to play 11 men on each side of the ball. That was the first time that had ever been done, because before then teams generally had 15 men uh-huh. on each side of the ball. And so that was the first time we did 11, and that idea stuck. But they also talked about how they were going to score the game. It was quite different from how we score it now. They talked about where's out of bounds going to be. You know, they were like school kids deciding, you know, how are you going to count blitzes in a schoolyard game. So they were inventing the game as they went along. As the 1880s, 1890s came along, you did have a rules committee that was governing the sport, and the rules were standardized. So the game was similar everywhere.
So I bought your book, and I didn't finish reading it. So you're welcome. So, if you love football, it's a fantastic book, but I haven't finished reading it, but tell me if I got this right. Was that the game where they decided that a touchdown actually didn't count for points, but only the conversions? Yeah.
This was one of the peculiarities of the scoring. So you think, you know, why is it called football? You know, because football sounds like soccer, right? Where the foot is the primary body part that you use. And of course, when we think of football today, American football, there are, you know, use your hands and your arms and so you know, why the foot? Why do we call it the football? It goes back to how they were scoring back then, because the only way you could score points in the very earliest days with these earliest embryonic forms of football was to kick the ball through the uprights. You had to kick it with your foot through the uprights like an extra point or a field goal. Mm-hmm. And what happened on that game in 1876 between Harvard and Yale is they decided how are you going to score? And they decided they adopted a kind of standard rule, which is if you scored a touchdown, you got no points. But what you got to do is kick the ball basically right in front of the uprights, which right. on that day, by the way, it was a pair of poles with a rope tied between them.
Yeah.
But essentially, you scored a touchdown, you got 0 points, but then you got to do the extra point. Right, what today we call the extra point.
Right,
and so you want to score a touchdown because then you had an easy kick for 1 point. You could also kick from at any point in the game, from any point on the field in the middle of a play. You could kick the ball, and if it went through the uprights, you got a point. But the purpose of scoring a touchdown was because it was almost a gimme. You then had a great chance. You had a great chance to score.
So was that the game too, or we have to go forward a few years where a field goal from the field was 4 points at that time?
There were all kinds of ways of doing it. So there were different variations, and it would be often what did the teams agree to? before the game started. They would have a gentleman's agreement about how they would score. In the 1880s, you started to get standardized. You know, if you score a touchdown at 6 points, and then you get 1 point for the extra point, and then a field goal is worth 3 points. So you know, the scoring as we know it comes into shape as the century closes. But in those very earliest days, when they were inventing the sport, they had all kinds of different ways to score the game.
And so, if I'm right, around 1896, the rules kind of start to become, they start to congeal, kind of, sort of?
A lot of them do. I mean, by then, this is definitely happening. There's a rules committee that governs college athletics and determines these rules, and they're becoming standardized everywhere.
The reason I was really wanted to interview you, and I find this, you tell me if I got this wrong, that between 1900 and 1905, that 5-year period, something like 160 people died on the field.
It's not that many, but it's a lot. So the statistic I like to use is that in the year 1905, 18 people died playing football, and this was a normal occurrence. Often a dozen people would die playing football, and this includes everybody from kids playing in schoolyards all the way up to big time college football. There were no pros at this point, as you say, but it was routine for players to die with head and neck injuries most often, because you know, if they didn't wear protective equipment, there were no helmets, and the era of the leather heads, if you remember,
yeah,
you know, have mental injury, that's still in the future.
Right.
They didn't wear protective equipment. So when your head comes into contact, you're trying to tackle a guy running with the ball. If your head comes into contact with his knee, you know, a guy running at full speed, that can be a calamitous, even deadly injury. And so you did see this problem where football was not just violent, it was also brutal and maybe even lethal. And lots of young men died playing the game. And so what happened is there was a social and political movement emerges and says, we've got to ban this sport. This is gladiatorial combat in the Roman amphitheater. We're more civilized than that. This sport cannot be allowed to continue. And they wanted to ban it. And they had some legislative success, but they wanted to do it everywhere. They wanted to do it nationally. They were pressuring colleges to drop the sport voluntarily, this sort of thing. This was a big social and political movement in the first part of the 20th century.
And some schools got out, and they ended up getting back in because just of the social pressure of the students. People loved this shit.
students loved the sport. So did alumni. Board members at colleges and universities also enjoyed the sport. The opposition tended to come from administrators and faculty who thought it was too violent. Also ordinary people. There was this was a broad-based social and political movement. Many newspapers were against it. So there were people on of all sorts lining up on different sides of this. And say what you will about the football banners, they'd actually identified a serious problem with the sport. I mean, who wants an activity where people die kind of routinely? You know, we're concerned about concussions today in football, and those are important considerations, and player safety matters, and the NFL and college football and all the way down to high school. I mean, this is an emphasis on the sport that you didn't have a generation ago. How can we keep these players safe in what can be a really violent sport? Back then, guys were dying, and so this was a problem to solve.
So in September of 1901, McKinley, the president, dies. The vice president, Theodore Roosevelt, becomes president. He's a huge fan of football. Around 1905, what happens? Does he basically just go to the colleges and say, "You guys fix this, or we're gonna have to stop it"? Or
that's pretty close to what happens. So Theodore Roosevelt is president. He's reelected on his own. He's elected on his own in 1904. And he's a big fan of football. He enjoys football. He also notices that it has this problem that people are dying, and he knows there's a movement to ban it. And so in October of 1905, he summons to the White House the three coaches from the biggest, most important, and best college football teams in the country, which were Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. So a lot's changed since then, but those were the best teams that year. invited the coach and the assistant coach from those three schools to the White House for a closed door meeting. And what he said in that meeting is, you guys have a problem, and if you don't solve it, you're going to lose it. He didn't threaten them, but he said these forces are too strong and they have a point. And he said, I want you guys to solve this problem. He basically said, I was not a football player myself. He was not. He didn't participate. He had eyesight problems and some health problems even. Great outdoorsman and led a life of vigor in many ways. But he was not a football player. And so he was actually reluctant to step in and say, here's what you must do or so on and so forth. He said, you guys go solve this problem. Because
he basically only had the bully pulpit, right? There's really nothing he could have done officially, is there?
Right, except he probably – right. Although with these progressives, you never know what they might try to achieve. You could imagine legislation or something. And in this case, he actually, you know, he didn't use the bully pulpit in the sense he didn't go and give a national speech about it. And so, but he did use it in the sense that maybe you can use it privately in a closed door meeting with coaches. But he said to those guys, he said, you've got to fix this problem or you're going to lose this sport. And that message landed in different ways with different coaches. The coach of Yale, whose name is Walter Camp, who's a legendary figure in the sport, didn't take Roosevelt all that seriously. He thought football was just fine. It was massively popular. The rules are perfect right now. Why change them? The coach at Harvard, who was also at the meeting, took Roosevelt's comments in a different way. And he thought, you know, he's right. We actually do need to figure out how to do this. He actually saw that the president of his own institution, a guy called Charles Eliot, who's probably the most influential figure in the history of American higher education, the president of Harvard at that moment, he was strongly against football. He wanted Harvard to drop football. And this coach of Harvard recognized that if Harvard dropped football, so would a bunch of other schools. You know, Harvard was influential. A lot of schools wanted to do what Harvard did. They would follow what Harvard did. And he thought, you know, we got to figure a way out of this problem. And so in the off season after that 1905 meeting, as 1905 moves into 1906, that off season, he convened a new rules committee, one that was different from the one that Walter Camp had dominated for many years. And on this rules committee, he adopted with his collaborators, with his allies, a series of rules changes regarding everything. Charge it takes to get a first down to making the personal foul a heavily penalized infraction, did a bunch of things that were all done with an eye toward player safety. But the major innovation, the thing that revolutionized the sport and changed it forever, is that this rules committee introduced the forward pass. And people have been talking about the forward pass for years, saying this would be an exciting element to add to the game. But Walter Camp didn't want to do it. There was a lot of resistance. They thought the game was just right. They said, we don't need the forward pass. Why would we do that?
Well, also, you have to mention something here, too. The ball itself was very different than the ball now.
The ball looks like a watermelon. So
yeah, that's right.
So it's kind of hard to throw.
Yeah.
You can throw it, but it's easier to kick than it is to throw. So it's got that odd shape. And so this new rules committee, though, says we're going to have the forward pass, and they introduce it and they say we're doing this for player safety because they thought we're going to spread the game across the field. And if we use more of the field, if we do this, we're going to have fewer of these gigantic pileups of big, massive men where all the injuries occur, and we're going to spread the game around the field. And so that's what they did. And they had to do some refinements in the next few years. But the bottom line is they both made the game safer because football's problem with lethality ended, essentially. It's not that no one ever suffers a grievous injury anymore, but you didn't have 18 guys dying every year. They actually made the game safer for the athletes, and they also made it a lot more exciting. I mean, who doesn't love a great passing game? The thrill of that in modern-day football – but it emerges from this period. And the committee, this rival committee, this new committee, this new rules committee that introduced this idea, today is actually known as the NCAA.
Yeah.
This is the birth of the NCAA out of this controversy. And there's Teddy Roosevelt at the center of it. He initiated a lot of these changes with that meeting at the White House. And then separately, he was lobbying for them privately in a letter writing campaign during that offseason. And the result is we get a safer game that is a lot more exciting.
Okay, so there's a quarterback at Wisconsin named Bradford Robinson who apparently got a heads up on this, and he's like the when the first couple of years they had this rule change, he's like the only person who could do it with any real proficiency, right?
Well, nobody knew what to do when they introduced the forward pass. There were no passing plays. Coaches didn't know how to use it, and so there was a lot of confusion. There was also an error they made in the rules. Is that initially, if you threw an incomplete pass, it was actually a turnover.
Yeah.
So basically, every incomplete pass was an interception. So as a result, very few coaches called passing plays initially. And then also you had the problem with the aerodynamics of the ball. They had to change it from the watermelon into the shape that we know now, which is called the oblate spheroid. And that took a few years. So there are all these examples of players and coaches who tried to figure out these rules, how to take advantage of them. You know, who threw the first forward pass ever? There's stories and legends and so forth.
Let me ask you. Yeah. Who do you think threw the first forward pass?
There's a guy, the convincing case I've heard, I don't have the name at my fingertips, but he was at St. Louis University.
I think that's the guy, that's Robinson, isn't it?
Okay, I don't recall the name, but what I've seen, it sounds like he was the first guy. But what really mattered, though, in the story of football is that this different people and teams innovated and tried things out, and there were rules changes, and so that by 1913 or so, you actually have an actual set of rules and a ball and some coaches that are willing to try some things, and the modern sport of football, American football as we know it today, is born.
And by that time, had they changed the rule where incomplete pass was not an interception? Had they changed it by 1913?
Yes, that was one of the things. That was one of the things they had to fix because it was too risky a play.
Right.
To initially, once they changed it in completion into just a loss of down, then teams were willing to try it.
Yeah. So I know you were talking about Walter Camp. A lot of people regard him as the father of modern football. Do you?
Yeah, I think if you want to point to a single person who is like the founding father of American football, you know, who is, if it's Abner Doubleday for baseball, who is it for football? Walter Camp is probably the best answer because he standardized a lot of the rules that we know now, the scoring that we know now. He was really there for all of it. Was a great innovator. The paradox is that he was the strongest opponent of the forward pass, a great resistor of that. So
did he come around eventually?
That's a good question. You know, I'm not sure. He certainly saw it develop and so forth, but he definitely resisted it in its early days.
Yeah. I want to move on here, John, if you don't mind. There's sure. another book you've written, which I have not really prepped the audience about, but I'm kind of I kind of want to talk about this. I got to admit, kind of for personal reasons, you wrote a book 25 years ago called The Unmaking of Americans, How Multiculturalism Has Undermined America's Assimilation Ethic. And let me tell you why I want to talk about this. I'm a first-generation American. Both my parents are from Eastern Europe. My father had me when he was 52, so he's essentially, my entire life, he was the age of my grandfather. So he came to the United States in 1920 when he was 17. I still remember him telling his story about him buying his first suit. He was so, and I'll just cut to the chase here. My point is that my parents, my father especially, but both of them, they wanted to become Americans. They did not want to import their own culture to the United States. They wanted to become, they believed in the melting pot. We're going to melt in, you know? And your book is 25 years old, and it seems kind of prescient at this point because I talked to more and more people on my show, commentators and stuff, and there seems to be a complaint that the current crop of immigrants, it's the opposite. It's like they do not want to join the melting pot. They want to bring their old culture to the United States. And is that what your book is about here? Or?
Well, I would put it a little bit differently. I would say that even today, a lot of immigrants really do want to become Americans. I mean, nobody understands the importance of learning English today in the United States like an immigrant who can't speak it. And if you talk to immigrant parents, they all want their kids to learn English, and they all think that the schools should teach it to them. The big problem is actually the elites. the people who have started to treat assimilation as a kind of dirty word, and the idea that Americanization is wrong because they don't have faith in America. And so these immigrant parents, they want to come to the United States and work, and these are hardworking people, and they want their kids to learn English because they want their kids to get ahead. The question is, will the schools teach it to them? Will the public schools teach it to them? Because a lot of these bilingual education programs and instructors, they don't believe in this. That's what the teachers' colleges are teaching. You got to preserve the native language. You got to maintain the immigrant culture and that sort of thing. And as everybody knows, we are a melting pot. That doesn't mean that immigrants need to abandon their cultures and who they are and the face they come here with and that sort of right. thing. But we do want them to become Americans. And what does that mean? That means speaking English. It means having faith in our system of government and so on, and adopting a lot of these patterns and so forth. And immigrant cultures can really enrich America. They can make it better. And that, you know, we see it in our meals all the time, right? I mean, without immigration, we wouldn't have spaghetti. We wouldn't have tacos. We wouldn't have kung pao chicken. I mean, all this great stuff.
Yes,
the Mexicans. And so they can really enrich it. But the idea of America is that we all become Americans. And that's what Ronald Reagan said. Yeah. He said, you know, the glory of America is that a Frenchman can come to America and become an American. A Japanese person can come to America and become an American. A person from India can come to America and become an American. The reverse is not true. You cannot, an American can't go to those places. You can't, an American can't go to French and be, France, France and become a Frenchman.
Yeah.
You know, you can learn French, you can try and adapt. And there are people who do this, of course, but America is unique in the sense that you can come here and become American. Immigrants want to do it. So many of them want to do it. They need the encouragement. They need the help. And too many of our elite institutions have turned their back on them.
So why do you think the elites think this way?
Because they don't believe in America anymore. They're critical of America. They think America is fundamentally racist. They think it was founded on injustices that have never gone away. And for all of America's imperfections, we know it's the greatest country in the history of the world. That's why the immigrants come here. They vote with their feet. You know, mm-hmm. People have an opportunity to move to this country, seize it. People, you ask randomly around the world, would you like to come to America? A lot of people say no. They prefer to stay home where their families are and so forth. But a lot of people want to come to America.
Now you're at Hilldale College, right?
I run the journalism program at Hillsdale College in Michigan,
which is kind of has a reputation of being a conservative university. Shall I say that more or less?
It has that reputation. Yes.
Right. So what happened on college campuses? Are these elite professors? I mean, I hate to say this. Are they just idiots? I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Well,
I swear
they're
on
actually,
the show all
actually,
the time.
Yeah, many of them are very smart people. But, you know, the old line about smart people don't make small mistakes, right? They make big ones. And for whatever reason, so many of our colleges and universities have become centers of anti-American sentiment. And we're seeing it right now with these horrible attacks in Israel, the murders of civilians, the beheadings, all this terrible, terrible stuff. We're now seeing groups breaking out to celebrate this on our campuses, to hail Hamas and to suggest that, or at the very least say, you know, these attacks need context. What a load of garbage
crap
that is, number one. Exactly. But number two, you know, it's on our campuses where this is happening.
Yeah.
Because these students are receiving encouragement from too many faculty members and from too many administrators who not only permit it. I mean, it's one thing to allow people in the spirit of free speech to say things, even if they're wrong and ought to be criticized for it, but actually encourage this kind of thing. The campuses have created this environment in so many places where that's possible. So the same people who are encouraging students to cheer on the murdering and terrorism of Hamas in Israel are the same people saying, you know, it's not so great to assimilate into American culture because this is a racist society and you shouldn't do that.
Yeah. We only have a couple minutes left here. I told you I keep you to our timeline. Very quickly, you're one of the founders of the College Fix, which is the largest read, most read conservative campus publication in America. And I know that because the editor-in-chief of the College Fix has been a guest on my previous shows many, many times, Jennifer Kamani. So I can, but so can you really quickly talk about the founding of that, how that happened?
Yeah, so first of all, Jennifer Kamani is an amazing editor of the College
Fix. Yes, she is. She's an amazing person.
She's probably a great guest on this show, better than me.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
About 13 years ago, I thought we need to improve journalism. We need better journalists.
Were you at Hilldale then?
No, although I was about to come here. And so I thought there are already several groups involved with campus journalism, and I'm a product of that myself. Mm-hmm. I was editor of a right of center student newspaper at the University of Michigan back 30 plus years ago. But as I say, about 13 years ago, I had this idea that with the power of the internet, we could create an organization that can work with any student on any campus in America to produce great journalism, but to have college students learn how to do journalism and then produce great journalism about what's really happening on their campuses. And so the College Fix is, number one, a daily higher education news website written primarily by students who are doing hard news stories about cancel culture, about violations of free speech and religious freedom on campus, about clubs that aren't allowed to, you know, conservative clubs, pro-life clubs that are not allowed to organize. And we're trying to do the journalism that asks hard questions of these institutions and professors and so forth, tell what's really happening, just using ordinary journalism. It's not opinion writing. It's let's investigate and just say what's happening.
Right.
And so that's every day we have news stories that explain what's really happening on our campuses. We're also trying to develop the next generation of talent. So we're trying to identify people who are 19 and 20 who are good writers, are creative storytellers, who want to become these things. We work with them, we train them up, we let them try journalism, see if this is a thing you might like to do. And then if they're interested in it professionally, we have ways of investing them through fellowships and helping them move into the professional ranks of journalism to make it better, to create some viewpoint diversity in a media that is overwhelmingly liberal and have a much better media than the one we've had for so long.
Well, it's not just that, John. The problem really is that you're teaching traditional journalism, and traditional journalism isn't being practiced much anymore, you know?
No, that's a big problem, and the idea that people are often confusing journalism with activism.
Yeah. Well, John, we got you have to go. So I told you I'd keep you to time. I hope you'll come back to talk about this in particular, journalism in general.
I'd be happy to. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you. I really appreciate you. This is a very great conversation, and we'll put your books up on our blog at jimandknight.com. And yeah, thank you, John. Appreciate
Excellent.
It.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.
You take care. We'll see you.
Bye-bye.
That was John J. Miller, professor of journalism at Hillsdale College, talking about two of his books, The Big Scrum and The Unmaking of Americans. I got that right, yeah. Interesting guy, very interesting guy. I hope you like hearing about football. I find the history of all, the history of freaking everything is fucking amazing. You know, I mean, you know, my brother-in-law used to say, you know, we're basically only 2 weeks out of the trees. And he's absolutely right. You know, I mean, okay, so this is, you know, this goes back about now 150 years, roughly. You know, we've only had electricity for 150 years. We've basically only had computers for 40 years. You've only had your iPhone for about 15, 16 years. This stuff has happened very, very quickly. And that actually brings me to my other topic tonight to end the show. And also, if you want to talk, you give me a call. Go to jimandknight.com. See right here. Right there, jimandknight.com/call. And click the blue button. Or if you want to leave me a text or a voicemail, the number is 408-458-5088. I do not check them while I'm on the air. This is a live show. Yes, I'm actually in a studio in Minneapolis talking at you, and it's going up to the satellite and down to your cable line or whatever the hell it is. But we're talking about the fact that things have happened so quickly. So, as I mentioned at the top of the show, and as I was talking to John, too, I went to the Michigan UP this weekend. And I met a friend. I have a couple of friends there, had a nice dinner party. And a couple of people at that dinner party knew I did the show. As a matter of fact, I think they'd watched it. And one of the women said, "So, do you really believe all that UFO shit?" And here's my answer to that. Well, first of all, I told her what I'm about to tell you. Yes, but it's not, and I've said this many times, it's not that I had some sort of belief or some feeling or any sort of bullshit like that. The reason I believe in all that UFO shit is because of government documents. And the next question everybody always has, well, if those documents are real, and I have to say a lot of people don't think they are. A lot of the research I've done, or that's been done for me over the years, I consider myself what I call a meta research. I basically research other people's research. A guy named John Greenwald runs The Black Vault. It's online at theblackvault.com. You can go see it. And he's been collecting, through the Freedom of Information Act, he's been collecting government documents on UFOs. There's a zillion of them. And people say, well, if there's so many of these documents, why doesn't the press report on this? And all I ever say is, that's a damn good question. I don't know. You know, the press, you just heard Mr. Miller talking about this. The press in this country has gotten just goofy. So there's a memo on the FBI archive website. I think it's called the FBI Vault, I think it's called. And the memo says, and I knew of the existence of the memo. I knew the summary. A couple weeks ago, I actually read it in total. I thought it was 4 pages long. It's only 1 page long. I read the whole thing. But it does say what I've always known that it says. It basically says somebody's writing back to J. Edgar Hoover at the Home Office in Washington, D.C., some agent. And he says, well, we've got this crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft and these 3 dead aliens. What do you want us to do with them? That's basically what the memo asks. They're asking the Home Office what they should do with the bodies and the equipment they've recovered. Well, and the interesting thing about that is, and I've said this before, there's a zillion documents that talk about UFOs. There's very, very few, almost none, that actually talk about like dead aliens, either alive or dead. There's virtually none. Matter of fact, this is one of the very few that I actually know brings this up. Now you'd think, but you won't have to think, if the FBI is talking about this, it has to be real. Now the FBI, their official take on this is that this was a huge mistake. Somebody made an error. It's not a crash spacecraft. There weren't any dead bodies. Somebody just was wrong, and that's what they're. And that's bullshit. It's like the thing at Roswell. What people forget is that in 1947, the Roswell Army Airfield was the only place in the entire world that had an atomic bomb ready bomb group, because they were the people that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And at that time, in 47, in the next year, in 48, the Russians finally get the atomic bomb. But at that point, we were the only place on the entire Earth that had them. Matter of fact, I don't even know if we had one, because we kind of fooled the Japanese. We only had 2 bombs. I mean, not 2 types of bombs. We only had 2 bombs. They were slightly different in their configuration. They were both, and so we used both of them. And we were basically trying to get the Japan to surrender. And they didn't surrender after the first one, but after we used the second one, they surrendered. Now, if they hadn't, I think they figured it would have taken at least 6 weeks for them to build another bomb, at the very minimum. So they only had 2 bombs. So they got kind of lucky. But if you're talking about aliens, I was going to say, okay, at Roswell, the thing is, so they're the only people in the entire world that have dropped atomic bombs. And so because of that, They were the absolute best and brightest of the Army Air Corps. At that point, the U.S. Air Force doesn't exist. It doesn't become existence into existence until later that year. It's called the Army Air Corps. In other words, the U.S. Army ran all the fighter planes and military aircraft in our arsenal. And so you're going to tell me that they couldn't tell the difference between an extraterrestrial spacecraft and a weather balloon? That's bullshit. Of course they can. These are literally the finest air people and the finest scientists in the entire U.S. military are at this base. They're not that stupid. They are not even close to that stupid. So okay, so you got a memo from the FBI that says we have dead aliens. You have they put out a press release. Roswell Airfield actually put out a press release saying we've recovered a quote unquote flying saucer. They actually said that. They changed it a day later. They said, oh, it was a mistake. It was just a weather balloon. It was not. I said, come on. You can't. These people aren't that dumb, you know. But the thing is, if you're going to look at a smoking gun, okay, so the FBI is telling the Home Office they have dead aliens. Well, doesn't that mean dead aliens exist, you know? So why the press hasn't reported on this stuff, I do not know. Now, these documents have been available for years and years. The document from the FBI is, I think, from 1953 or 55. It was before 1960, believe it or not. It was 70 years ago. There was a project run by the CIA in the 1970s called Operation Nightingale. And what it was is the CIA basically made a list of the 400 most prominent journalists in the entire U.S., all anywhere in the U.S., and basically offered money to all of them to either not report certain stories or to lie in reporting them. And they wanted to control the narrative of what they were had going on. And a lot of this had to do with the UFO stuff. Not entirely at all. But it was UFO stuff. It was highly sensitive, top secret information, that sort of stuff. So, and amazingly, a lot of these press people were so flattered they were asked by the government, some of them didn't even take the money. They were all offered a considerable amount of money to do this. So you have the start there of a huge disinformation campaign. But still, at some point, you would think somebody somewhere would have done enough. I'm a guy sitting in my underwear in my freaking room in Minneapolis, and I'm doing it. And, you know, no one wants to believe me. Oh, you know, you're just a guy in your underwear in Minneapolis. What do you know? You know, well, it turns out I know quite a lot. And because all this stuff was actually public. And John Greenwald got the same shit for years and years and years. He's publishing these documents that he's getting through the Freedom of Information Act directly from the U.S. government. And I don't know if there's any more that are that explosive in nature I'm not talking literally explosive. I'm talking about, you know, in terms of their impact as the two I just named. But still, there's a lot of, and like I said, I don't know many documents these documents that talk about aliens, but the ones about UFOs are all over the place. I mean, just hundreds and hundreds of them. And why didn't anybody report this? So finally, in December 2017, Leslie Keene and Ralph Blumenthal write this article in the New York Times. They say, oh, by the way, you know, the military actually thinks these things are real. And it's of course, it had to be in the New York Times. And this is also another thing, too. I get this constantly from my liberal friends. And it actually really bothers me. It's starting to really bother me more and more all the time. About when I talk about stuff on the show, and they'll say, well, you know, your problem is your information is incorrect. Why? Because you watch CNN? That's like why you know? I mean, I to prepare these shows, I read hundreds of news stories every day. I'm not kidding. I mean, hours and hours of reading to prepare for these shows. For me to decide on, and you know, you probably noticed, I'm a fucking blabbermouth. I can go on forever about two or three things. You know, I usually have way more material than I have time to talk about. But it's the constant thing is like, well, you know, your sources are wrong. So here Greenwald is getting this stuff from the government, directly from the government, and he gets the same shit. It's like, well, these things aren't real. No, they are. They are real. The government sent them to him in a package through the mail. He got them from the U.S. military. They're real. You know, how much, what do you need to know? Now, there's a lot of stuff I talk about on this show, which I usually preface as tinfoil hat crap, you know, about I do a lot of speculating. I do a lot of extrapolation, you know. But the fact is, are the UFOs real? Well, now, since the New York Times told us they are, we know they are. But we knew 50 years before that, or the government knew. And we knew the government knew. It's just, it's crazy. I've been dealing with the press, either working for the press or dealing as someone being reported on for over 50 years of my life. The first time news stories run on me, I was a child prodigy classical musician. And when I was 12 years old, a newspaper did a story on me. And at that, when I was interviewed by that guy, I'm 12. I told him something. I said, look, this is off the record, but I'm going to tell you this. And of course, he printed it. And the reason he printed it is because I'm 12 years old. Now, I'm too stupid to realize that. I didn't realize that. Well, what am I going to do? You know, well, nothing. I couldn't do nothing. But that was my very first experience with the press. And of course, it was a bad one. And I've been dealing with this shit all my life. I mean, I just don't believe it. Just the incompetency and also... I wouldn't say lack of belief, but ideological rigidness, you know. UFOs can't be real, therefore they aren't, you know. There's no one flying around in our atmosphere. No one would do. Well, think about this. We do the same thing, and I'm not saying we're going to do it. Excuse me, hold on a second. We are doing it. Are you familiar with what anthropologists call uncontacted tribes? There aren't many left on the planet, mostly in Africa. There's tribes of people, mostly in Africa, who are completely unaware of modern life. They're living 500, 600, 1,000 years in the past. They have no realization. Now, there's not many of them anymore. 75 years ago, in the middle of the 20th century, there's never been a lot, but there were much more than there are now. So we monitor these tribes. Anthropologists, they literally will go into the woods, into the jungle, and spy on these people and try not to be seen. Well, shit, we're doing that on our own frickin' planet. If we had the ability to fly around the galaxy, don't you think we'd be doing that other places too? You know? And so then you look at it from the other point of view. Okay, so they're intelligent, right? They're probably... You know, this is the thing I really want to know at some point, and no one's ever explained this to me in any satisfaction or deliberateness. Do the gray aliens, do they have emotions, or more specifically, do they find stuff funny? Is humor a universal concept? I really want to know that. I don't know if that's true or not, you know? Do they cry when their children die? I don't know. I do not know the answer to that question. This extrapolation seems to be more and more that they do. Clifford Stone, who worked as a quote-unquote translator, supposedly, this is his story, you know, and his story is one of these stories like Charles Hall. There's several people that have these stories that either what happened to them is real, what they're saying is real, or their imaginations are so frickin' detailed and full, they should be novelists. Charles Hall wrote 6 books about his experience with extraterrestrials at the Nellis Air Force Base in the 1960s. He claims that the Air Force built a secret base, and he doesn't actually know where these people were from. He called them the Tall Whites. He does not know what planet they're from. So they could land their spacecraft and repair them here. He's claimed that. He wrote 6 books on this. If that stuff isn't real, well, he's the greatest frickin' novelist of all time. I mean, shit. And I should point this out, too. He wrote the first book as a novel. And then he came back and said, when he wrote the second one, he said, no, I have to confess something here. It's actually true. This all happened. That's what he says. So he wasn't actually, the first time, he knew people were going to believe this anyway. And I don't know if I do anyway. But anyway, there's a guy named Clifford Stone who worked as a translator, so he says, with extraterrestrial beings, with ETs, for the Air Force, for the military, where if they crashed, They would send him there, and his job was to communicate with them, and they somehow figured out that the ETs, most of them, seem to communicate with telepathy, supposedly, but supposedly Stone has a particular talent where it was easier to connect to him than other people, and they figured that out, so they sent him. And he says that the ETs totally have family lives just like ours. It's like they have the same emotions. He says he said that he would often end up talking. Matter of fact, he would literally make small talk with them about their families and ask them about how, you know, how many kids they have, that sort of thing. He says it's very, very true. Now, the thing is, there's probably a lot of different type of life in the universe, and some of it isn't going to be, like, biologically based even, you know, it's like just weird. But there's also, there seems to be a lot kind of like us. So I don't know why, but why did I bring that up? You know, I don't, because it's not that inconceivable that once you get once you can fly faster than the speed of light, and also, and this is not bullshit I'm pulling out of my butt, we already know how to do that. It's just we can't manage the energy resources to accomplish it. Supposedly a small 30-foot aircraft or spacecraft with that seat two people would take more than the entire electricity produced on the entire planet to fly, supposedly. But my point is, theoretically, we know how to do this. So at some point, are we going to be able to do it? Probably. Almost certainly, I'd say. You know? So if you have the ability to fly around the planet, check different shit out, don't you think you're going to land and try and observe the natives? Don't you think you're going to do that? I had a friend of mine who doesn't buy any of this at all. But I have to say, he did have a very interesting point. He told me a couple of years ago, he said, this is the part I don't get, he says. All these people supposedly get abducted, hundreds of thousands, millions of them, and they all get an anal probe. He said, how many, he's kind of trying to be funny, but still he's got a point. He says, how many anuses do you have to probe before you have the right amount of information? And he's got a point. I thought about that because I've been thinking about that too. It's like all these people get examined. Well, shit, they're at some point, why do you need to examine another human? I mean, God, we're pretty much all alike, you know? And then I can't remember, was David Jacobs or Bud Hopkins in one of his books. Those are the two guys. You want to read books on abduction. Those two guys did the most research of anybody. And Jacobs is an old man now, and I don't think he actually talks to the press. But Hopkins died about maybe 8 years ago or something like that. But they said that the reason they did it was not actually, it's not an exploratory anal probe. They're actually trying to get sperm and eggs. That's what those guys have said. That, and you think about this too. If your civilization, and I've said this, you're talking about, you know, right now, supposedly the rumor that's been going around for quite a while is that the military has identified 60 to 70 different types of ETs, species, races, or whatever you want to call them, from different places. And they all come here. And Stanton Friedman who said that people assume all these species know each other. And he said it's probably nothing's further from the truth. A lot of them probably meet each other coming here to see us or places like us that are we're undeveloped, you know? I mean, you can't argue the fact that UFO sightings went up monstrously after we exploded the bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was like a calling card to the universe. Oh, these people made a benchmark. They figured this out. So all of a sudden, they're all coming here. And my guess is, and supposedly this is true, those explosions that we do of nuclear bombs and atomic bombs on planet Earth actually resonate quite a ways out into the universe, kind of like radio waves. But anyway, this is my justification for talking about this stuff. We would do the same thing. We have done the same thing, and we're going to do the same damn thing. So you got 60 different species of extraterrestrials, and they're probably anywhere from 200 to 1 million years ahead of us. Okay, so, you know, like I said, I started this conversation talking about the fact that you've only had your iPhone for about 15, 16 years. You know, give it 200 years. I predict that by before the end of this century, we will be flying faster than the speed of light. I don't know if I'm going to live to see it. I just had my 68th birthday. But before the end of the century, we will. Okay, what's that? 70 years from now? 80? You know? So once we can do that, you know? And then think about this. What if you're a million years ahead of us? A million years. And that's not, you know, considering the age of the universe and the age of different planets, that's not the least bit impossible at all. There's a distinct possibility you could have a race of intelligent beings that's a million years ahead of us. Well, at that point, their technology is fucking magic, you know? I mean, you read the Bible, Ezekiel, and all these things they saw in the sky. It's very easy. The ancient alien things, you know, is I can make fun of George Tsoukalos and how I wish I was, how he gets laid way, way, way more than I ever did. But the fact that there seems to be something to that, that what a lot of people, they couldn't have any words to explain this stuff. Now we understand enough about technology to know that more technology is going to happen. That's the thing. I have a friends who say, you know, that, you know, they're not coming because you can't fly faster than the speed of light. Well, like I said, first of all, we know that's not true. That's bullshit. But, you know, we figure shit out. That's what humans do. That's what any intelligent species does. It's a series of problems, and you basically solve them in order. I want to give you an example. In 1900, they didn't think the average that a human could survive going faster than 45 miles an hour, that it would kill you. No shit. That was 120 years ago. They thought that. Well, that turned out to be wrong. In the 1940s and 50s, they weren't sure if they were ever going to have an aircraft that flew faster than the speed of sound. There's a lot of people who thought it was impossible until Chuck Yeager did it. So, you know, basically nothing's impossible. I have a theory. My theory is that if you can perceive the problem, the solution already exists somewhere. That doesn't mean you're going to do it tomorrow, you know. But if you can perceive the problem, you will eventually solve it. Or we will eventually solve it. Maybe not you, personally. Your problems in your own personal life, yeah, it's the same thing. If you know there's a problem, there's a solution somewhere. You gotta find it. And that's our show for tonight. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. Tomorrow night, the King Brothers are joining us. This will be a lot of fun. They do a late night talk show in their garage, and it's actually like going places. So, yeah, that'll be fun. And Martha Zoller is joining us on Wednesday. She's a Atlanta radio talk show host. She's a really, really cool woman. I'm looking forward to talking to her. I hope you join us. You know, seriously, call me sometime, okay? You know, we don't get a lot of calls on the we've been doing this 10 weeks now. We don't get a lot of live phone calls. And I'm starting to think the reason is because people don't like to have their face on the screen. But you don't have to. Like I said, you can mute your camera. You do in the preview screen. There's a pull down for your camera. You choose no video, and you won't be seen. And people have done it before, and it works just fine. So we've even had like a couple of guests who have done it. Mark Tapscott, he was on here about a month ago. A reporter for the Epoch Times, he went no video because he was in a place where he couldn't, with any convenience, do the video. He couldn't actually do it. So he did no video, and it worked just fine. We talked to him. So that's our show for Monday, October 16th. I'm Jim Peters. Thanks for watching, everybody. Appreciate it. Like I said, you know, I don't want to harp on this. If you get a chance, go to Rumble and follow us or like us or do one of those things. I'd appreciate it a lot. Good night, Esperanza. Good night, Uncle Donnie. And good night to you, wherever you are. Here's the end card.